This is Mobius Podcast 392. I'm Todd Agosso with my good friend John Westfall. And before we start, I want to thank Don Sorcinelli for joining us last week. That was lots of fun. Mm-hmm. Oh, it's good to have Don on. We'll have more friends on.
It's always good to have Don on.
Yep. And we'll have more friends on.
Don is just an exciting individual from a number of perspectives. So.
He is. And, of course, he is our he completes the trio of our Mythical Conspiracy Views podcast that nobody's ever heard.
Yeah. And he's also Todd's replacement if Todd can't get to his own podcast.
Which has happened once. Has happened once and may happen again someday.
Yeah. So.
Okay. Let's see. Hey, John.
Yes.
So we're going to be talking a little bit about your weather pretty soon. But first, you know, I can't remember if I mentioned this in a earlier podcast because, you know, I'm old and my brain is deteriorating. But Google has a newish, I think it's a couple months old, progressive web app called simply Google Calculator. And you get there by going to calculator.apps.chrome. And it's really cool because it works on almost any browser. It doesn't have to be. It was originally, I think, designed for the Chromebook, but it works on any browser. I just used it in, I used it in a Chrome browser on my Mac. So it works on any platform, I should say. And it works fine. It's kind of a scientific calculator. It has a trig functions and it has probability and combination stuff and, you know, log and all that kind of good stuff. It's not programmable, so it's not that. And I do see a little switch at the top. Oh, it's interesting. My mouse is just not behaving itself today. Maybe low battery. Oh, it says radians, but I don't know how to switch from radians to degrees. Maybe if I click this. Nope. Maybe it's only radians? That's interesting. Oh, I see. There's a little click button here. Okay, there is a switch from degrees to radians, so that's not a big deal. Okay. So I just didn't want to mention that because it's, you know, it's free. Hopefully it doesn't die like many Google products does, but it's okay.
It is unfortunately so easy for Google products to die.
I know. Right? They're short-lived. They're like fruit flies.
Yeah, they are. It's somewhat depressing, but, you know, what are you going to do? Enjoy it while it lasts. That's
exactly.
The Google mantra, I suppose.
Right. Okay, the next thing, speaking of not short-lived, but just living, years ago, the only way you could buy a smartphone that I can recall, I think, was through a monthly plan, with the exception of the Apple iPhone, which, you know, raised a ruckus because it had a astronomical back then cost, I think, $600 for the first iPhone that you could buy outright. Because up until then, we all bought our phones, I think, on a, you know, monthly installment plan, essentially. And you can still do that with Verizon. You can still buy your phone, iPhone, outright. But if you get a Verizon monthly installment plan for your iPhone, you now have to have a contract for 3 years, which is kind of lengthy.
You know, and you put new, and I thought I was still on a 2 year, but I'm looking. So when I upgraded to my iPhone 13 Pro, you might remember I talked about that on the podcast, and they basically gave me the full price, but it's spread out over monthly payments.
Right.
And then I elected to get the higher storage, so literally I think I paid $3 a month toward that, because it's really a $3 premium just for the extra amount. But it was over 36 months, it was 30 something months, because I have 26 of them left. I've had them for 4 months now. So yeah, they of course will let you upgrade early at a certain point.
Sure.
It's interesting how it used to be, and then the providers didn't know quite how to keep you locked in, and now they've figured out how to keep you locked in again by doing these upgrade earlies. Of course, you can pay off the whole thing early if you want.
Yeah.
But it doesn't make any sense if you're getting those promotional packages. Like for me, if I pay it off early, I lose the promotional package.
Right.
So I'm not planning on upgrading my iPhone 13 Pro in the next 26 months anyway. I think I'll be happy with it for another couple of years. So,
not to mention, you're probably not considering changing carriers, which is, you know, very few people change carriers.
Anymore, you're right. And Verizon, while you do pay more, at least they have service pretty much everywhere except my in-laws' house, because they have no service for anything because they're in a valley. They also don't have broadband internet other than DSL. So,
right. You know,
there are still some sad places in the world when it comes to support for these things.
Well, as you know, years ago, my job was actually to look at broadband in Hawaii, at least. And so I got to, you know, be familiar with a lot of the broadband availability nationwide. And it is not near 100%. And in many states, it's not even close. You know, even in Hawaii, I think we're pretty high up in the chain. You know, I think we were over 80% at one point. But it depends how you look, because that's 80% of the population. But when I took a look at census mm-hmm. blocks, not tracks are bigger, blocks are smaller. 20% of the populated census blocks, and not all census blocks have people in them, but 20% of the populated census blocks had no wired broadband and pretty poor wireless broadband. So it was, you know, it's definitely not everywhere. But yeah. I've only switched carriers once. No, I've switched twice. I went from Sprint to AT&T for my main phone because oddly enough, it's because when my daughter was going to college in the mainland, Sprint coverage on her campus was just horrendous. And I don't think we had Wi-Fi calling back then. Or maybe we did, but her phone didn't. And AT&T had great coverage, so I switched to AT&T. I switched both of us to AT&T. And then I did dump T-Mobile in a fit of anger when they decided my grandfathered data plan at the time. This was years and years ago. They simply cut me off when my grandfather data plan died. Instead of telling me, hey, you want to switch to like a, you know, current data plan? No. And so I was literally walking down the street in downtown Honolulu and I had no data all of a sudden. And I called and said, oh, yeah, you're on a really old plan and we just cut you off. So I said, okay, I'm going to cut you off. And I went to Google Fi, which uses T-Mobile, ironically, but I don't, you know. Any rate, they're much... Okay, and the last thing I wanted to mention, which I found really interesting, because, you know, in the old days, John, and, you know, you're not old as me, but you probably remember back when you could actually, you know, take something apart and fix it. And
oh, yeah.
It is very difficult to fix consumer electronics these days. In fact, most of it is unfixable from the point of view of, you know, 99% of the people who touch them. You know, just opening them requires surgical skill. And so, you know, it's interesting that Google now wants to teach high school students, I guess, you know, wants to provide classes on how to repair Chromebooks, which are very popular in K-12, as you know, and popular in my home because I love Chromebooks. So I thought that was really interesting, and I really hope, you know, the schools that offer Chromebooks to their students, I hope they also take up Google in this plan. It'll probably save them a ton of money and, you know, maybe the kids will get some real interest in electronics and computers and so forth. That'd be pretty cool.
I'm just thinking of the poor students that's going to be, well, you broke your Chromebook. Now you got to take the class and learn how to fix it. There'll be some districts where, you know, what's your homework tonight? Well, I got math, science, and I have to fix my own Chromebook before I can even do any of that.
Yeah, or you got to be real nice to the kids who are, you know, like the A students in the Chromebook repair class.
Exactly.
But I thought that was really neat because, well, A, it means I guess Chromebooks are repairable. I mean, I've never taken apart mine, to be honest. But it does say Acer and Lenovo are their only two OEMs participating in a repair plan. So if you've got a Samsung or, you know, Asus or whatever else, no, that's not going to happen. In fact, it doesn't even mention Google, so I guess Google Chromebooks are not part of the plan, which is weird. I thought they still sold Chromebooks. I should look, actually. I don't know. There's the Google Chromebooks, by the way, generally so expensive that I've never even considered buying one. Although I think I was tempted to buy the Slate a couple of years ago, but that was just priced way too high. But, you know, interesting.
I stayed away from Chromebooks mostly because they're the bane of my existence, teaching people how to use certain software because none of it runs on a Chromebook.
Oh,
you know, the stats packages that I use, and, you know, R and everything else.
Really, R should run on a Chromebook.
It should, but I've not had much luck with it, and I've certainly never had luck with running it in a way that my students could figure out.
Okay,
so there's probably some hack around ways to get R running on a Chromebook.
I'll try.
But at least last I checked.
Okay, I'll give it a whirl. I'll let you know if I have any luck. And by running, you mean with a GUI interface and stuff, right? Not just command line.
Yes. Yeah.
Okay. Okay, I'll go take a look at that because now I'm kind of curious. Any rate, you know, there's been a movement of late, at least in our neck of the woods, to try to encourage high school students to get sort of real life certifications in various kinds of technologies, like you know, Cisco and cloud technologies and various things like that. So it'll be interesting to see if this joins that trend, or is part of that trend. I kind of like the idea. You know, I'm not sure this sort of practical education is a replacement for college. As a college professor, I think you don't either. But I think, you know, it's a good option to provide. Okay.
Yeah, I'd agree with that.
John needs students entering college every single year.
Yeah, I would like to have that, you know, for a little while longer. Yep.
All right. Now, John, your topic, I hadn't thought about this in a while.
And yeah.
Go ahead, John. I'm sorry. Just thinking out loud.
Oh, no. No, so this is a topic that I go back and forth on about yearly. And as we talked in the last couple of weeks, Google Apps, the free tier, is going away. So I sort of simplified down, and I thought, you know what? Maybe I'm going to try the iOS and macOS stock applications for a little bit, because for a long time I'd used Outlook as my email client on both Mac and iOS, and I'd also used a third-party to-do list product instead of using Reminders, and I thought, you know, let me give it a shot, because Apple makes these improvements over time, and you know, Google does the same for Android, and whatever your platform du jour is, you've got stock apps for Reminders or To Do, and you've got all that. So I thought, let me just try this and see how it works. So I went back to iOS Mail and macOS Mail, so just Mail on my devices. I went to iOS Reminders, which I had not used since they'd been overhauled a couple of years ago. And a few interesting observations. The first is, and this is something I'd known for a while, iOS Mail really has the workflow down if you're sent a PDF that you then have to mark up and send back to someone. That is, if you've never had to do that, it's very nice on iOS, where you can literally open it, the attachment, make your changes, and then there'll be an actual quick option for, do you want to, you know, reply all with this as the attachment. So when people send you forms, like I often get, where it's please fill this out and send it back to us, that is much easier than Outlook ever was. So that's an interesting thing if you've never done it, that you might need that functionality. But the new things that I noticed. So Reminders on iOS now have smart lists, which are basically rule-based lists, just like you can have a rule-based mailbox where, you know, find all the messages there, this or that, which is nice because it can let you select certain tags. So tags are also new with Reminders in the last couple of years. The weird thing is that you don't get a not operator. So I wanted to create a tag that would not show up in my smart lists. And the only way I could get around it if I wanted to would be to add all the other tags to a smart list except the one.
Yeah.
So that's a little bit disappointing that there's no negation operator for tags. Tags are, Apple is doing something with them, but not quite coherent yet, because they're synced up between Reminders and Notes, but not email and calendar. So Calendar has its own flags, and Mail has its own flags, and iOS and macOS has its own flags, but not tags. So I would like to see some parity there between those. And probably the weirdest one, and this is one that if our listeners do want to try this, they definitely need to know. A fairly common use scenario, I think, is having a mail item that you want to use, you want to make a reminder out of. You know, reply to this or follow up on this, etc. And there is a nice way to make a reminder so that it's got the little mail icon on it. You can click on the mail icon. It will bring up the piece of mail so you can reply to it or whatever. So you could set, you know, reply to this email in 3 days and then have a quick action to take you to that message directly. So if you've already filed it away, you don't have to keep it in your inbox. But the way that you create that reminder is completely stupid. If you haven't used iOS's mail application or macOS's mail application, they are walled gardens inside of a walled garden. And the reason I say that is there's no share button. you know, we're used to seeing a share button in iOS or macOS, right, where you can right click on something and choose share, and it then opens into all the other things you might do. You can do this in Safari, you can do it everywhere else, but there's no share buttons in macOS mail or in iOS mail. So you might think, well, how do I share it to the reminder list? And if you go on Apple's support documents, they have a thing where it's like, oh yeah, you can do it. You have to right click on the subject line of the email and choose share and then choose reminders. And I right clicked on the email and there was no share option. I thought, what am I missing here? And then I reread it and saw the words, right click on the subject line of the email and choose share. So that literally means the little tiny subject line, select it, right click on it, and choose share, not the email item in your inbox. That's too easy. Gotta do the subject line. Then you can hit share, then you can hit reminder, and it will create that nice linked reminder that goes straight to that email item. But it is
share.
Completely stupid that that's how you get to the share option.
I didn't know that.
By right clicking or tapping on the subject line specifically.
I have never tried this.
Yeah, it is. Isn't that just like, I don't know. I saw that and I was about ready to curse Apple, and I'm usually a pretty lenient person with Apple.
I've never
but
heard
this
you curse.
Idea that I have to collect all of that to get to a share is just completely dumb. But now that everyone knows about it, it does make it a lot easier to share items out from mail. Because that's how you do it. You can't do it by tapping on the item like you would be able to do everywhere else on the planet. It has to be on the subject line. So I have no idea how long I'm going to stay on iOS mail and iOS reminders and smart lists and all that. I suspect I will probably try to give it a go up until WWDC this year and see if they announce anything that's really cool at WWDC to enhance these things. And if they announce enhancements, I'll probably stay on it longer. But if not, if they haven't done anything that's going to make my life easier, I might go back to my third-party utilities. And I'm curious, what do you use on your devices? Are you using stock apps or do you use third-party apps? Why or why not?
You know, it's interesting. And I wrote it down because I was thinking about it while you were talking. And so on iOS devices, specifically iPad and iPhone, I use three different mail clients, but for different reasons. I use iOS mail because it's the fastest in terms of it's got the mail there when I open it. But I don't like the way some of the functions in it work, like reply. So if I'm going to reply, I'll open up Gmail and reply to it. And I do have everything going into iOS mail. So, you know, I do see everything there. I think Gmail, I've got mostly everything going, except Hotmail or, you know, Outlook.com now, I guess. And I use Outlook, the Outlook iOS app, specifically for Hotmail Outlook.com, because Microsoft has such terrible spam filters. I'm not sure that, you know, I don't want to overwork Google's spam filters. So I just go in there and and clean it up manually. And I cannot tell you how bad Microsoft spam filters are. They are just like useless. The stuff that comes in through there are just amazing. I never see it in any other spam filter that I use. And it's just really kind of, especially since, at least until I think for next 2 weeks, I have a paid Outlook.com premium account on top of my Office 365 paid subscription. And it still has, you know, so I'm paying money and it still has terrible spam filter. I used a stock iOS reminder because it kind of works the way I like or I need for me. Mm-hmm. I don't have a real complex needs. And it has actually improved in the last version or two. So, you know, like you said, the smart list and so forth. And I like the geofencing you can do with it, although I wish I could make the geofencing a little bit tighter. But that's okay. And let's see, what else do you have up there? Notes. Notes is just talking about sharing. But yeah, so that's kind of my thing. Oddly enough, I do use, browser-wise, although I use Safari most of the time, I do have DuckDuckGo on. If I run into a site that seems particularly annoying and, you know, I just want to like filter out stupid stuff. But although, and I think most people have forgotten that we still do have ad blockers that can be run in Safari, you know, as an iOS app. I sometimes forget I bought them. I still have them. So I bought two of them, Crystal and Purify. I don't even know which one I have activated mm-hmm. right now. Although I do get warnings now and then that say, hey, you have an ad blocker on, you mind unblocking? And sometimes I go, yeah, I do mind because you're really spammy, even though your content is somewhat interesting. But what do you use for browsers on your iOS devices? Do you use Safari all the time? Or?
So I use Safari most of the time. The only alternative, the only reason I use anything else is I do use Firefox on iOS.
Oh, interesting.
When I'm teaching certain classes yeah. where the integrated software I use for grading doesn't work on Safari. It only works on Firefox.
Wow.
So last summer I had a class where I was using one of these publishers' websites. I think it wasn't Macmillan. It was another one of them. It might have been McGraw-Hill. Where it would only run on Firefox. And I wanted to do my grading on Firefox in the morning. So I installed Firefox. I wanted to do my grading on my iPad instead of having to sit at my MacBook. It worked fine on Safari on the MacBook. It just did not work on the on iOS.
You know, and which Firefox are you using? Because I don't even know if there's more than one. I did see that they had something called Firefox Focus, which I downloaded, but then I don't remember using. I don't remember why I downloaded it now. But
yeah, I just used regular Firefox on iOS, whatever the official Firefox was.
Okay. Oh, I'm looking at it
now. And I'm still looking for a solution if anyone has one. If anyone has one, I'm still looking for a solution to synchronize my Safari, iOS, and or my Safari, my Firefox, and my Chrome bookmarks. Because the way I was doing it for a while was using a Windows machine that had iCloud installed on it, which is one way to do it because iCloud can do it on Windows. This is completely dumb that that's the way you do it. But every so often it would just completely destroy all of my bookmarks or the order would get out of whack. So I killed that. So now it's like once a couple of months I manually delete all of my Firefox and Chrome bookmarks and then re-import the ones from Safari, but that's not a great solution.
Interesting. You know, and going back a little bit up to in our discussion about scripting, where you're talking about syncing tags and writing scripts and so forth. I was just thinking, you know, Apple is terrible at automation. Let me rephrase that. Apple has had great automation tools. They're just terrible at maintaining them. You know, I was thinking about HyperCard to start with. And they, you know, they killed a bunch of great products or, you know, deprecated them to the point where they're useless. And they kept changing so much that I just gave up. And I said, not going to worry about it. They're sort of bad at automation the way Google is bad at messaging, you know, with their 15 million messaging apps, most of which failed. And social. Yeah, and Apple's never even tried social,
yeah.
I think.
Yeah, Google.
Yeah.
Oh, they did. What was the one?
The music
that
one?
Was in iTunes.
Yeah.
Mobile? Yeah.
Yeah.
Wasn't it started with a P. Was it Ping or something like that?
Something like that, yeah. It's so bad we can't remember the name.
Yeah, I think that was it. Yeah, iTunes Ping was a software-based music-oriented social networking and recommender system developed. It launched in 2010. And when did it die? It died in 2012. So the 2 years. Apple at least knows when to say it ain't working and gets rid of it. But
yeah. But, you know, and I was never a HyperCard expert by any means, although I did play with it a little bit and I bought a book to learn about it and all that. But I was just checking, you know, it died. Wow. The final release was 1998. I mean, it's been gone a long time. And, you know, I still kind of miss it. You know, like, it's like, hey, you know, it was a pretty cool idea for non-programmers.
HyperCard is what Myst was originally written in. Mm. You know, and so
I didn't know
it's got a long history. I believe that was the case. I watched that just a few weeks ago. One of the documentaries on Myst was talking about, I believe it was HyperCard. The other thing, every so often, I still use Mac OS Automator. Automator is still around, and even though Shortcuts has gotten a lot of the hype, Automator can do some things that you don't think about. For example, if I have a PDF that needs to be assembled, you know, and I've got like say 30 PDFs and they all need to be combined into one,
right,
it's a lot quicker to open up Automator and make the workflow and then hit the button and have it automate all that into one PDF versus opening Preview and dragging pages in and dragging pages in and dragging pages in. Same thing if you have to slice and dice PDFs, Automator can do it a lot quicker than doing it by hand.
Yeah. By the way, I just looked it up, and the opening line, this Ars Technica article, is Myst is probably the most famous project in HyperCard history. So there you go. Your memory is correct. I did not know that.
Like I said, I just seen there's a documentary on YouTube right now that's on Myst. I think it's on YouTube. One of the creators put it out there, and it talks a lot about why Myst was created the way it was and how it was created the way it was. So,
yeah, there's a bunch of articles about it. I got to go back. I should go look at the documentary. It's probably easier than actually, you know, reading words. Being lazy and all. And I think it just started raining behind me. Yep, just started raining. Even though the forecast said sunny all day, so... Liar, liar, pants on fire. Okay, and I was just thinking about other things that I use that on iOS especially. You know, on macOS, I don't use any mail app at all. In fact, I would say that for Windows too.
You're just a Gmail or Outlook. Yeah, just web.
Yep.
Yeah, I've thought about that. You know what? Mail app actually is surprisingly good for search, and I had not realized this until recently. So in order to do a backup of my email, I use Thunderbird.
Oh, I remember that.
Because Thunderbird will let you add multiple accounts, and it actually works pretty well from a number of levels. But Thunderbird search is actually pretty cool, too. I can... you know, you can do a timeline view and a number of other things. So if you're looking for an email solution, plus Thunderbird will support backing up to either, and you know, you can actually have it set up to do MailDir type style backup. So it'll create EML files for everything, which is how I like to have my emails. That it's plain text searchable. I would recommend, if you're looking for a backup solution for your mail, set up Thunderbird, have it download everything regularly, and you'll find it's also a good unified search console for your email archives.
That's interesting. I will say that years ago, I can't remember when I stopped using it, but I used Thunderbird and liked it for many, many, many years. So I did use a client, and that was it. And that was the only. I gave up an Outlook years ago as a client, except at work, where I'm kind of forced to use it. But yeah, Thunderbird was great. I can't remember why I stopped using it. I think it was just a hassle every time I changed computers to, you know, install Thunderbird and configure it and, you know, all that kind of good stuff. So I said, I'm just going to the web. One and done. Yeah, completely forgot about Thunderbird. It was great. There's another one it had too. What was the other counterpart to it? It was Firefox, Thunderbird, and there's a third app, but I can't remember. That was kind of interesting.
I do think there was another, but I can't remember what it was either.
Yeah, obviously not as important as Thunderbird and Firefox. Okay, and lastly, it's something that I don't really think about much in Hawaii, but you have an item that you recommend for people in cold climates.
So this is one of those things where I've been going out for walks and my climate has been pretty cold lately in the mornings when I go out. I go out at the coldest time of the day, 6 a.m., because I'm an idiot. And I was telling my wife one day, I said, you know, they make those hand warmers that are chemical-based hand warmers you can buy, and they're like single-use sort of things. I said, there have to be rechargeable hand warmers now. And if you did not realize it, yes, there are rechargeable hand warmers, and they actually are a novel idea because they've used something that we already know about in the tech world, and that is a rechargeable USB battery. So you can go on Amazon, and I have a link that we can put in the show notes to the one I bought, which is literally two little external batteries with a magnetic connection together, so they stick together when they're in transit, and you can take them apart and put them one in each hand when you're using them. You can put them into heating mode, and they will warm up the outside. The outside of them is metal, so it'll get nice and warm and keep your hands from freezing in your pockets as you're walking. in 20 degree weather like I've been doing the last few mornings. And if you want, you can also just put them into battery charging mode and plug in your cell phone the way you would to any other external battery and charge your cell phone off of them. Yeah, it's a good use of both of those, and you recharge them over USB-C just like you would recharge a rechargeable battery. So I've been very happy with them. And like I said, you can't really beat the price. It's $33 or so for these two little external batteries, and they're 5,000 milliamp batteries. Yeah. So that's enough to get a good, decent charge on your cell phone if your cell phone's dead. Of course, if you have cold hands and your cell phone's dead, you have to choose between the warmth of your hands and your cell phone. So I don't know if you're, you know, it really depends on what your priorities are, I suppose.
There is one.
Definitely a cool tool.
There is one caveat, and I'm on the Amazon page now looking at it. There's one caveat I find kind of interesting. So it has two input USB-C ports that can charge two devices, which I guess is output. And I guess the input, they mean literally charging the hand warmer itself. And it says, please don't input both charging ports at the same time. Can you charge both of them from one port when they're magnetically attached?
You know, I suppose you could, because you could plug in... Yeah, but I have not. When they send it to you, they do send you two USB A to C cables. So you could charge both of the sides at the same time. But that is interesting. Yeah, I've been pretty happy with them over the last couple of days. And you can definitely, and you can find similar ones that are a little bit bigger. The thing I liked about these is that it did have the magnetic connection, so yeah, that they fit nicely in your pocket. And if you're really cold in one hand, you could keep them together and turn both sides on and just grasp the whole thing like a, you know, big disc. If you don't want to break them in two.
Okay, and I'm looking at some photos. It looks like you can charge both devices by plugging in just one port when they're magnetically attached. So at least that's what the photo seems to imply.
Well, no, you cannot. You have to charge each side separately. There's no electrodes on them. It's just a
I thought it was some kind of empty part thing.
So you do have to do it separate. Yeah,
okay,
but it doesn't take that long. I've charged them up. I use them for three mornings for 45 minutes at a time, and I have charged up one side already in a couple hours, and the other side is almost fully charged, so they do not take too long to charge.
Yeah, and you know, I should note, John, that, you know, although I don't live in a cold part of Hawaii, there are parts of Hawaii that get pretty darn cold. I mean, you know, down in the 40s and so forth, which is for us is cold. But for those of you in those areas like Volcano National Park on the Big Island, you're out of luck, because like most rechargeable items, this item cannot be shipped to Hawaii. So
let's get it smuggled in somehow.
Smuggled in. You got to go fly over and have it delivered to your hotel and then bring it back, which I had to do once with... Yes. I know, Bluetooth earbuds. They wouldn't ship to Hawaii because of the, I don't know why, because the batteries are not huge. But so what I ended up doing is I had them, when my daughter was in college in the mainland, I had to ship to her. And then when I went to visit her, I picked them up from her. So that worked out okay. Turned out they weren't very good earbuds, so worth the effort. Wasn't quite worth the effort. Anywho. That's about all I have, but we managed to fill up a half an hour plus, so we did good.
We're good at this stuff.
Yep.
We're good at making mountains out of molehills.
There we go. Any rate, I did not see Coconut make an appearance this week.
No, they're running around. Coconut and his brother are running around making, you know, a lot of noise, so they're having cat fun time, you know. They don't need any hand warmers. They're keeping their own heat up.
Alrighty. So this has been Mobiles Podcast 392, and we will talk to you next time. Hopefully with a friend. We'll have to go invite some friends.